ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Hey, this is Jason Gay coming up on the Free For All WSJ podcast. Ariel Helwani, who is basically the Howard Cosell of UFC, knows everybody and everything. We're going to talk about the sport, its growth, and all the spectacular things that are happening in the steel cage on the Free For All.
This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, it's your friend Jason, and we are back here on a Free For All, and I want to apologize at the top that we haven't done a Free For All in a while. And I appreciate the kind notes from listeners, you know who you are, asking when the heck we were going to do one of these again. And the truth is that I'd been on the road a lot, stuff going on with the Chicago Cubs. I don't know if you'd know this, but they won the World Series a couple weeks ago. It was kind of a big deal. And just haven't been in the studio. But we're back, and today I have a guest who I was really, really psyched to talk to, named Ariel Helwani, who is, you know, basically the, I don't know, the Bob Costas slash Howard Cosell slash Adam Schefter of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, the UFC. And the UFC just had a giant event here in New York City, UFC 205. First time they've been in Madison Square Garden, and it was a tremendous, crazy night with a headliner, the Irish fighter Conor McGregor, winning in a very impressive physical performance, and just kind of a smash debut for an organization that had been banned from this region for quite a long time. So Ariel knows everybody and everything. He's had his ups and downs with covering the sport, but you know, when the essential histories are written of the UFCs, his name will be right there at the top if he's not done it himself. Again, you don't really get the opportunity to talk to somebody who knows the insides and outsides of any endeavor, not just sports, in the way that Ariel does. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. If you don't know anything about the UFC, I want to say right up front, this is for you, because I don't know a heck of a lot about it. I find it really compelling, and I've covered it a little bit, but not a lot. So a lot of the questions that I'm going to be asking him are questions that you may have. I'm very interested in the idea of where the UFC takes it from here, whether it can mainstream itself, it has new ownership, if it continue to grow, or if there's a ceiling on its growth for reasons that, are some complicated and some not. So we talk about all this stuff, and we did it all over the phone, so we never touched gloves. Coming up, here's Ariel. All right, I just want to get into it right here with Ariel Helwani. Ariel, first of all, Saturday night, I've been in Madison Square Garden for a number of events that have considered themselves big time, and this was a pretty electric atmosphere. I'd put it up right there in the top three or four things that I've experienced in that garden, and you've seen so many of these events. How would you characterize it in terms of the electricity in the room, in terms of what it meant for the UFC in general?
Well, first off, thank you very much for having me on the show. I mean, it was a mix of emotions. Obviously, it was a long time coming. I mean, those of us who have been covering the sport have really been sort of talking and breaking down and dreaming about what the UFC's debut at MSG would look like. You know, through every sort of passing year, we would kind of say, okay, this would be the ideal card, and the next year, this would be the ideal card based on, who's the top guy. So now here we are. We finally have the card, and it kind of got put together at the last minute, to be honest, and there's specific reasons for that. But, once we actually got there on Saturday night, and I must say it was a bit of a late-arriving crowd. I think it was kind of like a Las Vegas high-roller crowd. Usually when the UFC goes to an event, to an arena or a city for the first time, that event, is obviously sold out within seconds, but the crowd shows up from, the moment the doors open and obviously are staying until the end. They're like 90% full from, the first fight on. That was not the case on Saturday. And I think that's because a lot of, very important people bought these tickets and they're maybe not the most hardcore fans. And I thought the event went a little long because of the three title fights. But once McGregor got there, you could tell that something special was happening. And it's not, in boxing, it's common to see the likes of Madonna and Hugh Jackman you know, Odell Beckham, those kind of people in the front row. And UFC, not so much, especially outside of Vegas. It felt like, you know, okay, we've sort of arrived. This is a big deal. And if Conor could pull this off in front of these people, he's going to reach a different stratosphere. And I think that's exactly what happened.
Now, how much of that celebrity turnout was the work of the UFC's new owner? You know, there was a pretty seismic thing that happened for the organization this summer where the talent agency, William Morris Endeavor IMG, or they're bigger than a talent agency now, purchased the UFC from the Furtado brothers for $4 billion. And they have made it pretty clear from the get-go that they are looking to broaden and mainstream and celebrify the UFC. They've had taken on some celebrity investors and so on, and we'll get to that. But was that some of their stagecraft in getting the Madonnas and so on there?
You know, I wonder, and actually it's a fantastic question because I actually said that to one of my colleagues on Fight Night. I wonder how much, you know, Ari Emanuel and company had to do with getting these people there. I mean, New York is New York, and this was a big deal, and
sure.
Conor McGregor is a big deal. So I'm sure that they had something to do with it. I mean, I've been told, you know, they first really came into play at UFC 202 as far as taking over the company.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of celebrities at that one in Las Vegas. You know, all of a sudden Kanye West is showing up and many others. So I'm sure they had a lot to do with it. But I do think, you know, any celebrity living in New York wants to be at a big event. And Saturday night in New York, the big event was the UFC. And Conor McGregor, in my opinion, I took some heat for this for saying it on Monday, but I think he's in the conversation with the Ronaldos and the Messis and the LeBron Jameses of the world, worldwide international sporting icon. I think people want to see him in person, and I think that he alone brought out some of those people as well.
It is really interesting, isn't it? Because he is, anyone who gets the opportunity to watch him, whether you're watching him live or, you know, you buy the pay-per-view and you see the fight, there is an electricity and there is something incredibly magnetic and compelling about the guy that goes beyond just the, you know, brazen press conferences that he's also become famous for. You know, you can't take your eyes off of him, and you're right. There's only a handful of global athletes in the world who sort of fall into that category. Does it surprise you? Because, you know, I think as little as a year ago, there was quite a great deal of skepticism about McGregor's, you know, true fight ability and potential, that some people thought he was a creation of his own mind and hype. And, you know, we've seen him ride that roller coaster up and down a little bit, even in the course of this year. Are you surprised to see him standing as tall as he is right now?
Honestly, I'm not. And you may not believe me for saying this, but I am not, because when he first came into the UFC, I kind of put all my chips on his side of the table. And a lot of people were telling me, like, man, you know, why do you talk about Conor so much? So Conor came on my show, the MMA Hour, in February of 2013, a month and a half or so before his UFC debut. And honestly, the main reason why I had him on was because his fans were hounding me to have him on the show. You got to talk to Conor. You got to talk to Conor. They are so passionate. They are so loyal to him. And so I had him on. And at the end of the interview, I said, that's the greatest interview in the history of this show. He was unbelievable. And he was the exact same guy, but with a twist. He would tell me that he was on welfare, that he doesn't have a pot to piss in, that he doesn't have a car. And it's amazing to just go back 3.5 years ago and listen to him speak like that when, you know, you see the way he lives now. And every step of the way, he continued to, you know, sort of defy the odds, defy the critics, fight incredibly well. I mean, you could just see from his fighting style, and there were people, because he was so brash, because he was somewhat obnoxious, who refused to allow themselves to, you know, really believe that this guy is worthy of all this praise and attention. I remember when he debuted in Dublin, as far as the UFC is concerned, in July of 2014, I had to beg my bosses to send us there. And I was like, this is Conor fighting in Dublin in front of his people. He's in the main event. Yes, it's not the greatest card of all time, but this is a big deal just because of him alone. And it ended up being one of the best trips that we've ever done.
Yeah.
So, and now, of course, I don't have, you know, they can't get enough of Conor McGregor. all this to say that, you know, he's just a great fighter, and people don't want to give him the credit that he deserves. In fact, I think they still don't give him the credit that he deserves. I think he's the most underpaid fighter in the UFC. He might be still the most disrespected fighter in the UFC as far as his talent is concerned. If the next guy that he fights, whoever that may be, whenever that may be, tells us that he's been coddled, that he's been protected by the UFC, that he's not worth anything, you deserve to be ridiculed at this point, because he is a very, very, very good fighter, and he deserves all the praise that he has received.
Now, you mentioned the money part, and I'm going to ask you some real ignorant questions here, but I'm very fascinated by the business angle of the UFC, of course, with, you know, the journal and so on. But what? How does it work for a UFC fighter? What are they? Is he getting a flat fee, or is he getting a percentage of the take on the pay-per-view, or is it some combination of that? And is every fighter different?
Yes, so every fighter is different. So Conor gets a fee to just fight, and then he gets a percentage of the pay-per-view. So he's kind of like a partner in this.
Right.
Very few fighters get a percentage of the pay-per-view. Typically, it's the champions. There's a few exceptions here or there. There's even a couple of champions who don't get pay-per-view points because they're not big draws, so they'd like to get more, you know, up front. Mm-hmm. A guy like Conor, you know, he'll sell the heck out of a pay-per-view, make a boatload just to show up, and then as a result of his drawing power, as a result of him selling the fight, his promotion, then he'll make a hell of a lot more on the back end because of, you know, how many pay-per-views he sells. So everyone is different. The unfortunate part about the current state of the sport is it's all very hush-hush.
Yeah.
They don't disclose it. And they'll come out, like you'll see if you Google, you know, UFC 202 salaries, they'll disclose X amount to the Nevada Athletic Commission, but historically, those numbers have always, more often than not, been inaccurate. The UFC believes, this is what they'll tell you, that we're not going to tell you, the public, and the other fighters, everyone else, the real amount that these fighters are making, because we're afraid for their well-being. We don't want hanger-oners to come to them. We don't want leeches to come to them. We want them to be left, you know, alone in peace with their money. We all know that that's BS. They just don't want guys to know how much they're actually making so that they can negotiate properly. I think those times are going to change, but as of right now, it's impossible for me to really tell you how much Conor actually made because it's not public.
Well, there was a fighter who had his fight pulled because his opponent dropped out. Was it Donald Cerrone? Is it Cerrone?
Cerrone,
the cowboy.
And
I think he said that he was out $150,000. Now, $150,000, you and I know, is nothing to sneeze at. But in the proportion of what a major global sporting event is, I thought that was really light money. I mean, the idea of somebody in a major marquee boxing match getting $150,000 to fight is crazy. And that sort of staggered me and made me realize that there has to be this incredible disparity throughout the UFC in terms of what people are getting paid.
Yes, and this is a very, very hot topic in this particular year. I mean, the topic of money and pay and unions, I mean, this is the most fascinating year in the history of mixed martial arts for various reasons, that being one of them. And actually, Donald, he told me this after he found out that he couldn't fight on Saturday because his opponent failed to make weight. He was very upset. So in Donald's case, he gets show money and win money. But here's the crazy thing. So, you know, it's still kind of up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of work by their own discretion here. So Donald didn't actually fight. They can reserve the right to not pay him. They say, look, he didn't fight.
Right.
But because he weighed in, they gave him his show money.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get his win money because he didn't actually fight.
Right.
I think that that's BS because your opponent missed weight. He, you know, he didn't show up. You were there.
Right.
You did what you had to do. You were a professional. You made weight.
Sure.
They've already allocated this money, you know, the win and show money to these guys when they were preparing for the card. So Kelvin Gastelum is getting nothing because he failed to make weight, and he shouldn't get anything because he wasn't professional.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you give Cowboy his win money? Because there was a chance that he was going to win on Saturday as well. Why is he only getting his show money? Give that money that you were going to give to one of them. Don't penalize Cowboy Cerrone. So there's so many issues like that. But yeah, you're right. It isn't a lot. And guess what? Cowboy is actually one of the higher paid fighters on the card.
That's fascinating. McGregor, in his press conference after his win on Saturday, or rather Sunday morning, made a little bit of noise about the fact that, look, WME, IMG has hopped in here and given celebrities a cut now. I think those are probably PR investment things. I don't think Conan O'Brien has 20% of the UFC and so on. I think it's designed to get a headline. But he said, look,
in the $250,000 range.
Yeah, so, you know, fractional investments here. And certainly not a figure that would get Conor McGregor too excited. And yet, he is, you know, making a lot of noise at a press conference saying, look, there are new owners and they got to come meet me and I'm the guy stirring the drink. And it's pretty hard to argue against the idea of him stirring the drink. But what I wondered is how much of that kind of ruckus is for show and how much of it is real. And can Conor McGregor be a kind of change agent who shines a light on some of that financial inequity or, you know, the lower pay? And, you know, we saw it a little bit with some of the stuff happening around 200 and his relationship to that event. You know, is there potential for him to be the guy who kind of, you know, pulls back the curtain on the business of the UFC?
He has already done so. I mean, he has made the million-dollar purse like just a thing that we talk about as opposed to being this unattainable goal. Him talking about, you know, nine-figure salary, 10-figure salary, things like that. I mean, 2 years ago, we're laughing at any fighter who even, like, mentions that. Yeah. Regardless, you know, like, he's actually talking about it in a serious manner, not in a joking manner. 2 years ago, that's just a complete joke. So he has already done that. And that's why sometimes it's frustrating that his peers, his fighters, don't recognize that he's actually helping them out as well. Yeah, they may be annoyed that he's getting, quote-unquote, preferential treatment or that the UFC may cater to him. There's obviously reasons for that because he's such a big draw. But a rising tide is lifting all boats here. And, you know, I think that, look, people love, dating back to Vince McMahon and Stone Cold Steve Austin in the 90s, people love the idea of an employee fighting with his employer because a lot of us would love to punch out our employer, right? That's what that whole feud was about
right.
in the late 90s. And I think there's an element to that here, but the majority of everything that he's saying is deeply rooted in truth. I mean, they have had their issues. I mean, at the end of UFC 202, the last thing he said at the press conference after he beat Nate Diaz in August was, I have a feeling that expletive is going to hit the fan. And he was talking about his relationship with the UFC. Now, yeah. I think he put that aside to fight on this historic card, but yeah. I think now we're back to that point. To me, it's mind-boggling that the new UFC owners haven't sat down with him properly and talked to him about the future and his yeah. part in the company and the success that they've had together and things like that.
Yeah.
So at this point, he's got the two belts. He's got all the power. He's got all the money. He can make money outside of fighting. Not saying that he's walking away, but he's in a very comfortable spot. He's right to say, come talk to me and tell me what's up here. Now, I don't think they're going to give him a piece of the company. There's a conflict of interest there. But
right.
he's the highest paid fighter, and he's still the most underpaid fighter, if you get what I'm saying.
Do you have an idea, Ariel, like what, you know, his take might be for an event like Saturday? I mean, what he might be pulling away when you consider all the...
Yeah, first, we don't know what the pay-per-view did,
right.
so that plays into it.
But we're going to suspect that it was pretty solid.
If it's less than $10 million, I'm shocked.
Yeah.
So it's somewhere in that range. And again, that may not sound big to the NBA, NFL, MLB reporter. In our world, that's historic. This is uncharted territory for us. Like we didn't even sneeze at that number not that long ago, and he did it.
Yeah.
So you know what's the crazy thing? He called it. He actually said that he was going to be the guy making this money and put a number attached to it. He actually just retweeted a tweet that he had in June of 2014. So he's in the midst of recovering from ACL. He's about to fight on that Dublin card. And he says, I'm going to have two belts and a share in the company. He said this in 2014. And at the time, I caught it pretty quickly. At the time, the tweet had something like maybe 300 retweets. Now it has like 50,000 because he unearthed it. But like, no one really took him seriously when he said that sort of thing. And so he was dreaming about this way back then.
Does it create an interesting power dynamic within the UFC that you have, in addition to the fact that you have these new owners, you have in Dana White, somebody who has been, basically the unquestioned, CEO / Svengali / promoter / pot stirrer for the UFC forever, almost, and... has kind of had, he's been the face of the product. You've had these, important fighters over the years and, you've seen celebrity types now with Rousey and McGregor. But here McGregor comes in and, certainly from a putting butts in seats standpoint, he's inarguably a bigger figure to the UFC in the moment than somebody like Dana White is. And does that create a strange dynamic all of a sudden?
It has at times. I mean, you referenced the UFC 200 debacle. I mean, that was a power struggle.
Yeah.
And, Conor says he doesn't want to show up. They pull him from the card. He retires. They put on this press conference, leaving the seat open for him, hoping that Nate Diaz is going to ridicule him. Nate Diaz, you know, teams up with Connor and goes against the UFC. I mean, that 3 month stretch, someone could write a book about that. That was just fascinating theater. And one of the things that I really enjoy out of Connor these days is how uncomfortable he makes the UFC executive. I mean, every step of the way. When he talks, he shows up in January, and this is leading up to the first time he was trying to fight champion versus champion. He was going to fight a guy named Rafael Dos Anjos in March. Yeah. So they have this press conference in January, and he starts ridiculing the marketing team for the lack of originality in the poster that they came up with. And he's like, where's my belt on the poster? Why aren't you guys promoting this properly? I'm going to go in there and fire all of you. And he's doing this in front of Dana White.
Right.
You know, coming out on Saturday to that song saying, I run New York and I get money and things like that. I mean, he's sending a message. And then when he walks in, and I don't know if you caught this sort of thing, but when he walks into the cage doing that funny strut, that's his homage to Vince McMahon.
Vince McMahon,
that's
exactly.
That's his billionaire strut.
Yep.
But when he does it, look at who he's looking at. He's looking at all the executives sitting in the front row. He's telling them that I'm the man here.
Right.
You guys aren't the man. I'm the man.
Right.
And then when he talks about shares and things like that, so it's constant messages being thrown. He did this whole little rhyme on Thursday at the press conference saying, you know, without me, this whole ship is going to sink. So he's constantly doing that, and it makes them uncomfortable because no one's ever done that before. And I find that to be very interesting.
Do you have a sense for how hands-on, hands-off the new owners are? Because, you know, I was fascinated to see some of the media materials, their names on it, like saying, you know, welcome to the UFC. We hope you have a great experience, yada, yada. And, like, you know, names other than Dana White and, you know, what that relationship is like.
Well, It's really coming into play now. I mean, it obviously took some time. They had a lot to sort of digest as far as where the company stands. But just around, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago now, they laid off a significant portion of the company. They wanted to downplay it and say it was less than 15%, but it was a significant portion of the company that they laid off, and it was also a lot of key executives who were laid off. So right now they're kind of working in this transitional period where, okay, they've assessed the company. I'm being told that more layoffs are to come in December, and they have some events that they need to get through, and then I think that they're going to reassess where they stand with the company, but they're starting to bring in their own people, and they, you know, being WME, IMG, but Ari Emanuel was there. I saw him there. Patrick Whitesell was there. I saw him there as well. So these are the key faces who are now involved, and you know, you're starting to hear more and more, you know, from managers and things like that. Their interactions are starting to change a little bit. It's the game is definitely changing, and it wasn't going to happen overnight. And by the way, anyone who thought that, you know, these guys were going to buy the UFC for $4 billion and then just keep it status quo and keep all the executives there and all the employees there, I mean, you're fooling yourself. So I don't begrudge them.
Yeah.
I have a bit of an issue with the way they went about doing it, like how they fired everyone and how long it took them to do so. And just I thought it was somewhat botched. But, you know, I'm curious to see what they do. The one other thing that's interesting, maybe from your perspective as well, is that they have not talked to anyone yet as far as media is concerned.
Yeah, we asked. I asked. Mm-hmm.
It's weird, right? Like, they don't want to talk to anyone.
Well, I also figured that someone was going to do a big sit-down before 205 because I just felt here's a marquee event. It's in the media capital of the planet, and, you know, it's basically a touchdown dance for them, and I was surprised that they did not do that. We gave them the option.
Yeah, I saw Dana was upset with your lack of coverage. Where were you guys?
Well, the irony of that, it was a beautiful Dana moment. And listen, he's as compelling as a character as there is in sports. And I've had the privilege to interview a few times, and like, he's always hilarious. But that was very funny because he did single me out when I asked a press conference question saying, where have you guys been? There was in the paper that very day a Q&A with Dana White in the Wall Street Journal. So maybe he doesn't get the Saturday paper.
But,
I don't know.
But you know what that says, you know, they have always been, and this is dating back to when Dana, Lorenzo Fertitta, Frank Fertitta owned the UFC, they have always been obsessed with getting mainstream coverage and in particular newspaper coverage.
Yeah.
Because for the longest time they were just the internet sport.
Yep.
And so this is a big deal for them that the Wall Street Journal wants to talk to them, that the Times wants to talk to them, etc.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, they're kind of that kid in school, the cafeteria, who's ignored, and now finally you guys are looking at them. So it shows that even though they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars now, they still have that ingrained in them, and they're still looking for your coverage, and I guess somewhat disappointed that they didn't get enough of it. So they're still the same guys as they were, you know, over a decade ago when they were fighting tooth and nail for any kind of coverage.
Yeah. Well, we're now going to have 6 pages of mixed martial arts coverage in every paper. So
really? You know, wow.
We have actually really, I mean, I'm not here to defend the journal's coverage, but in addition to the sports part of it, it's been a very compelling business story, and people who have been on that desk have been watching it closely for a while. I want to take a quick break and come right back with more with Ariel.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. This is Free for All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We are here with Ariel Helwani, who is, I don't know how you would characterize it, but I think of you as, you know, the preeminent mixed martial arts reporter in the United States.
Thank you.
You've been somebody who has been around the sport, knows the sport. You are unvarnished about the sport. You have had your run-ins with this organization in the past. What is the status of your relationship with the UFC these days? Because there was a brief moment in which you were banned. So
for
how
life.
Are things now? Banned for life.
Yeah. You know, things are kind of interesting. I haven't talked to Dana since that night in Inglewood, California, that was and he told me to leave. And I didn't speak to Lorenzo before he left the company. The first event that I came back to as a credentialed media member was UFC 200. And that was a very uncomfortable event to cover because I don't know if they were instructed to do so. I don't know if they were afraid to do otherwise, but everyone just ignored me. Like every employee, it seemed, just ignored me. They saw me walking down the hall and they just pretend like I had some really bad virus and walked the other direction. Over time, that has cooled down and everyone's been pretty nice to me. It was interesting though. I work for MMAfighting.com. We're owned by Vox Media.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, we're the number one website. That's just not, you know, something I say. The numbers would back that up. We're the number one website that covers this sport day in and day out.
Yeah.
The best coverage. We had two writers there, myself, a videographer, and a photographer. As far as, like, the reporters, the two writers and myself, none of us were cage side. We were all on the rafters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that their way of telling us how they feel about us? I don't know. But it's always funny to me when it comes to, like, the big events that they'll sort of forget the people who are covering them day to day.
Yeah.
They'll roll out the red carpet for those who will come, you know, once every blue moon.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like there's a balance there because there aren't, believe it or not, that many people who cover MMA for a living.
Sure.
Day in and day out. Their sole source of income is MMA reporting. And so I feel like they could do a better job of, you know, taking care of their own. But I actually kind of like it in a way because I don't want to feel beholden to them ever, especially after what happened in June.
Right.
So I'm okay. As long as, you know, there's no incidents, there's no roughing us up in the back, there's no, you know, bullying and all that, you don't have to talk to us. I'm okay. We're going to get by. We're going to do great coverage. It would be better if we had a nicer relationship, obviously, but I think over time, I'm hopeful that will come back.
From the outside of it, looking at who you get on your show and talk to, it does seem like everybody in the fight community has continued your relationship. I mean,
yes. Actually, it's gone like better than it ever was.
And yeah.
I'll never forget the first show that I did when I was still banned. I did a show on that Monday afternoon, which weirdly enough, and is still our most watched show ever.
Mm-hmm.
That was just me kind of like laying all my cards on the table and telling everyone what happened. The following week, I wanted to come back really strong. So I think I had two champions, a former champion, you know, a who's who. And I'll never forget it. It's something I'll remember until, you know, I stopped covering this sport. And then some. Every fighter in their own way said something to support me. Hey, like it was either like, hey, Ariel, you're my guy. I'll always be there for you. Or I can't believe what happened. You know, I'm glad to see you back. Every one of them made a point to say something like that publicly on the show, and that meant the world to me. And, you know, the managers, the fighters, the coaches, the fellow media members, the mainstream sports media members, I mean, that 48 hours is something that I'll never forget, just the way people supported me. I mean, just the fans, Twitter, yeah. Instagram. It was surreal to watch it happen in front of my eyes. So, yeah, I cannot complain about anything that has happened to me after.
Yeah.
In some ways, it was, you know, a very big positive for me.
I mean, is stuff like this growing pains of a, you know, still... You know, I don't want to say nascent sport because it's been around for quite a long time, but in terms of its mainstream mind share, you know, continuing to grow and develop and, you know, go after things. Are these some of the growing pains that are sort of characteristic of a young organization that may not be accustomed to the kind of traditional coverage that sports are given and supposed to be given?
Sure. I mean, when I was having that conversation with Dana as he was kicking me out, I mean, in his perfect world, that conversation was going to last 5 seconds. He just said, get out of here, you're done. And I tried to have, you know, a cordial conversation with him. And I said, you know, what I did, what you're mad about is no different than what Adam Schefter, Woj, Bob McKenzie in Canada. I mean, I was just reporting that someone was close to signing a fight. That's it. It was no, you know, commentary, no opinion. That's it. And what I wanted to tell him, but he knows this, like, the bigger you guys get, the more of this is going to come your way, and this is not a bad thing for you guys. This is what you guys wanted. You wanted that media coverage.
For sure.
They were used to just people doing what they were told. Like, this is the information, go run with it, not digging a little deeper. And so they had a hard time coming to terms with the fact that people were actually developing sources and talking to people and actually doing real reporting.
And that sort of being emblematic of their growth, because I think of it as being something that, you know, like you mentioned Woj and Adam Schefter and so on. I mean, I'm sure there are moments when, you know, league officials with the NFL or NBA, you know, rolling their eyes because they're dealing with something they don't want to be dealing with on the time frame that they're dealing with it, but they recognize the bigger picture of it being all, you know, generally positive.
You know, the other thing is, just sorry to interrupt, is that I don't think they expected the backlash, because they've actually banned reporters before, and it stayed in our bubble.
Yeah.
And Dana, you know, did an interview afterwards kind of taking a shot at me, saying like, oh, Ariel went on this pity party and spoke to everyone about it. And I was like, yeah, I had to speak to everyone about it. I mean, I was fighting for my career, everything I worked for.
Yep.
If I would have been foolish to turn down Rich Eisen and Dan Patrick and Lebatard. They needed to know about this, not just for me, but what all of us go through on a daily basis covering the sport. And I don't think they expected it to get out of the MMA bubble quite like it did.
But at the same time, I think any reporter and the circumstance you went through is rather extraordinary. But you know, you want to get back to a point where you're like, you're back doing your job. And do you feel like there? Do you feel like you're close to that or closer certainly
100%.
Than you were? Yeah, yeah.
The main difference these days really is just like I don't have the close relationship that I had with Dana. I mean, he has really, and even when I did my show the Monday after, I never took a shot at him or anything like that, because he really, you know, helped make me. I mean, I'm very, very, very much in debt to him. I owe him a lot. I'm very grateful for what he has done for me. I mean, he was doing interviews with me. If he never talks to me ever again, I probably have interviewed him more and will interview him more than anyone.
Yeah.
You know, because he was just so accessible to me.
Yeah. And that was part of what the charm of the UFC was for a lot of media, I think. I mean, if you're accustomed to covering, you know, mainstream professional sports like basketball or football or so on, you're lucky to get 30 seconds in an elevator with Roger Goodell once in your career. But here was a commissioner of a sport who was making himself incredibly available, and on top of it was almost universally a colorful, great, fun, pugilistic interview. I want to just go to something, you know, in that vein, but broader, about the idea of where the ceiling is for UFC, because that sort of fascinates me. Because, you know, when the $4 billion figure came out, you know, there was part of me that thought, well, you know, that's a giant sport with pay-per-view audience. It's global, and, you know, it's about twice the price of the Los Angeles Clippers. I think that makes sense. And then other folks thought it was a really, really crazy high price given what they believed to be, you know, a limit on the growth and popularity of it. And, you know, as someone close to it, I'm curious to get your thoughts about how high, how far can they take this sport, you know, domestically, globally, and so on.
Okay, well, first off, I was shocked when I heard the number. I mean, again, we're not privy to their financials.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to really know, but it was the first time that any sort of number had ever been officially attached to the sport, and in particular the promotion. And that was a very dangerous thing for them, because now a lot of the fighters
have
been saying, like, wait a second, you know, what? You guys sold this for $4 billion?
Sure.
You know, so, I mean, the first thing that jumped out at me was, wow, the fighters were way more underpaid than I thought they were. If they're, you know, without the fighters, there is no UFC. So, you know, they're really banking on their new TV deal. Their U.S. TV deal is up in a little over 2 years.
Yeah.
They're currently with Fox, and it's an exclusive deal with Fox.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been some talk that, you know, they're hoping to get around $400 million a year for this new TV deal. Currently, they get a little over $100 million a year. So that's obviously a big jump, and, you know, they'd be making a lot of money. And that's just the USA deal, not the Canadian deal, the Brazil deal, which they get a ton of money from, you know, over in the U.K., et cetera, et cetera.
Can I ask a dumb question about the TV deal, which is that when Fox is paying for that $400 million or $100 million, whatever they're paying now, they're not getting any cut of pay-per-view, or is that also part of it?
No, they don't get anything.
So, I mean, the proposal for this new TV deal, will there be any kind of carrot out there saying, like, okay, maybe you guys will get a cut of the pay-per-view, or is it always going to be just sort of the other stuff? Because that seems to me a strange relationship, because, you know, you're getting all these other things and these satellite fights and, you know, the show and all the talent and so on, but you're not getting the best possible thing.
Right, yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, look, on Saturday, FS1, their ratings for the prelims, so they aired 2 hours of prelims leading up to the pay-per-view. They got 1.8 million viewers, and I think that's their third best ever off the top of my head. You know,
that surprises me. That's a little low. Did you think it would set a record?
I thought, well, the record is, I think the record is 202. Connor Nate won.
So it's not way off.
Yeah, I didn't think it would surpass it just because, you know, that fight had a little more buzz going into it because of the rivalry.
There were also some crazy college football games happening that night.
That's true. That's true. You have to take that into account. And when Connor fought Nate for the second time in August, that was in August. So, like, there's not a lot going on as far as sports and big-time sports. But, you know, what's your typical Saturday night on FS1 doing? It's not doing 1.8 million.
Right.
So it's a good thing for them. And then they get the pre-fight show, and they get the post-fight show, and they get a ton of events like this weekend. So, you know, look, I don't know if they're worth $400 million a year, and I don't know if anyone's going to want to pay that. And there's some talk that they want to split it up like the other sports, like get a little bit on ESPN, a little bit on FS1.
Oh,
I think that would actually be really good for them if they do that.
Sure. It does seem like ESPN is romancing the UFC at a higher level than ever before. Is that fair to say?
100%.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a few years ago, it's interesting, a few years ago, they actually had a much more robust online team covering it, and then they let go of everyone except for one guy, and this was right before the Conor McGregor-Ronda Rousey boom. And I wonder if they would have waited, you know, of course, you know, sometimes who knows what's going to happen, but if they just would have waited a little longer, if they would have done that. But now it definitely feels like they're doing a lot more. They're covering a lot more. You see it a lot more on SportsCenter and other people talking about it. And it's amazing. The relationship between the UFC and ESPN and UFC and Fox is so fascinating to me, because for the longest time, UFC has made no bones of the fact that they want to be in bed with ESPN. They love ESPN. ESPN is number one. Why wouldn't you want to be in bed with them?
Yeah.
And then they got Fox over here who pays them the money. And, you know, every time Dana White has a big announcement, a big breaking news story, he goes to ESPN, and Fox can do nothing about it. And they do everything for ESPN. ESPN says jump, they say how high, and it makes sense because they're ESPN. But, you know, I used to work for Fox, and I know how they feel. And continuously they feel slighted by the fact that they're paying all this money and they can't get the same kind of love. So that dynamic in its own right is fascinating.
Yeah. Do you think ESPN is in it to win it, or do you think they're kind of manipulating a little bit here and it's trying to, like, you know, do you think that they have an idea in their head of taking over the sport?
I think that they are interested. I think that once – and this is just my take on them just starting to – I mean, they're – to me, it always felt weird, you know, even a couple of years ago. For example, UFC 129, 55,000 people at the Rogers Center in Toronto, George St. Pierre headlining their first event in Toronto. And it always felt weird to me that, like, there's 55,000 people who bought tickets to this sporting event on a Saturday night, and ESPN, like, completely ignored it. It did not exist to them.
Yeah.
That always felt like there can't be this much demand and it's not good enough for ESPN. Yeah. Now that has changed. And now they're, you know, they're coming to the events, and they're doing, like, you know, post fight shows and things like that from the events. I think they clearly see the value. I mean, you see what they're doing with WWE right now. It makes a lot of sense. MMA coverage, especially online, gets a lot of traffic because fans aren't used to, you know, a lot of outlets covering it. So it's not like it's, you know, splintered all over the place. So I know that their coverage does well. I know that their ratings do well when they put out MMA content, and they can get, you know, the big dogs. They can get Ronda, Connor, Dana, sure, et cetera. So why wouldn't they be interested now? Well, it's going to be interesting in 2 years what they do, but I do think they'll be a player.
Well, and also this is clearly why it had to be attractive to WME, is the idea of if you have product which has a demographic similar to UFC and you have a contract coming up at a time when there is a massive free-for-all in network television for virtually anything that can grab that very hard to reach young male 18 to 34 age group and, you know, grow it beyond that, that's a really hot thing to have, and that's, you know, you see it all across the sports spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the perfect time to get in, and I think Lorenzo Fertitta, the deal that he made, we could do a whole other show on this, you know, buying the company for $2 million,
right,
selling it for $4 billion, but just getting out when he did was just so darn brilliant. I mean, seeing the potential wave of the union talk coming his way, the Muhammad Ali Act, you know, this TV deal being up, so there's questions, okay, we can get so much more. I thought he just got out at the perfect time. You know, Connor is at an all-time high. Ronda's coming back. You know, New York was opening up. It was just so perfect for him to get out now. And I think it's another interesting thing to watch is, you know, how long does Dana White stay for? Because there's something about waking up in those satin sheets. You know, you've got $400 million in the bank now. You know, does this guy pulling out of that fight, does it really mean all that much as it did when you were, you know, on the ground fighting? And he's a fighter, and I know he loves it.
Yeah.
But things have changed, and his boys aren't there with him anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just made a lot of money. So I'm curious to see how long he sticks around for as well. There's so much. I equate this time to 1920s football when they were just playing with leather helmets. We're going to look back on this era 20 years from now.
Really?
I can't believe things were going down like this. Yeah, this is 1920s football, in my opinion.
Well, let me ask you, you know, and I don't mean to sound skeptical or cynical about this, but we are in a moment where there is a great deal of attention being paid to both the short and long-term impact from concussions and head injuries and so on, and every sport that deals with them. And let's be clear, this is a topic that is far beyond just fighting and football. This, you know, encompasses many, many sports. But, you know, there's some sort of volatility around their long-term, viability. And, you know, again, going back to the idea of a ceiling here for the sport, if in fact you think there is one, you know, is there some vulnerability as well for this sport?
Yes, 100%. I mean, I still, Dana always liked to say that, you know, we're going to be bigger than the NFL, we're going to be bigger than soccer worldwide. I never believed that. At the end of the day, I mean, I recognize that this is two men or women fighting in a cage with very small gloves. There's always going to be, you know, a sector of society that just finds this bizarre. And especially when you're channel flipping and you come across two people on the ground, you're like, what is this? You know,
well,
like,
more than bizarre, who find it off-putting. I mean, who you know, personally reject it. Yeah, sure.
Sure, sure. So that, I mean, that alone is going to stop it from surpassing the NFL and EPL, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, the injuries, we're going to find out soon. You know, the UFC is only 23 years old, and you're starting to see, you know, there's a wave of guys who really helped put the UFC on the map around 10 years ago who are now retiring. Well, what are those guys going to look like in 10, 20 years?
Yeah.
You know, you hear things. I mean, I know of guys who are battling things, and we're going to see more and more of it, especially with more fights being put on and more fighters coming to the UFC. So, you know, like any of this data that you read about, you know, the sport of MMA being safer than boxing, I mean, I don't know if it's really fair to compare the two because boxing has been around for so long. They're really two different sports. In boxing, you get punched in the head repeatedly. In MMA, you can win different ways.
Right.
But the UFC is doing kind of their part. I mean, they have been teaming up with the Cleveland Clinic, and they've been trying. I think they've been trying to get ahead of it, but we're only truly going to find out how dangerous the sport is, in my opinion, in the next two or three decades.
One thing that felt marginalizing to me, in fairness, and I say this as a total outsider, is that starting the McGregor fight at 1:20 in the morning. Now, I respect the fact that it is a big country and a big world out there, and there are people overseas and other parts of the world, Latin America, Brazil, so on, that are obsessive about this as well, Asia. It still seems freaking crazy to start your marquee fight at 1:20 in the morning, New York time.
Oh, man, you are preaching to the choir here. So I can't go. There's around like 45, 46 events this year. I'll go to like half of them.
Yeah.
And for example, you know, this Saturday, actually, they have two events, which is absurd. And, you know, these events are like 6 hours long each. But, you know, the Saturday night event from Brazil, you know, the main event is going to come out at 1 a.m. And you're sitting there for 6 hours on your couch watching this if you're not at the event. And there are times where I start to like question my passion for the sport. Like they're actually like killing the fan inside of me because the events just drag way too long. This is the only sports league that in America that caters to the West Coast. If you're a West Coast UFC fan, you're sitting pretty.
Yeah.
It's absurd to do it so late. And I hope with the new TV deal that they change it because it's very hard to watch. You know, the majority of viewers are on the East Coast. You're forcing them to stay out that late, especially pay-per-view is even crazier. Now, Saturday was a little different because there were three title fights and the two other ones went long, so typically they don't go that long.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it's weird to put your marquee, you know, moment on around midnight.
Is there fragility in the UFC in the respect that, you know, we talked at the top about Conor McGregor, and you mentioned Ronda Rousey, who, you know, Dana White has said himself is the most seismic figure in the history of the sport. And at the time, I think he said it, he was including Conor in that mix. He might say something a little differently now. But, you know, Ronda was a transformative figure in not just the UFC, but in sport in general, just in terms of both her, you know, talent and magnetism, but her economic power. But, you know, we're not sure how long she's going to be in this thing. And, you know, also Conor McGregor. I mean, we forget Conor McGregor lost pretty badly this year, and had the second fight with Diaz gone another way, this would be a very different conversation about Conor McGregor. Is there a fragility about the nature of the sport? And I appreciate the other side of it is this is kind of what fans, true fans, love about it too, is that, you know, any given day, anyone can lose to anyone, and nothing is given, and you're not trying to set up guys with patsies and so on, and that's what they like. You know, fights get made, good fights get made, and you're constantly having to prove yourself. But at the same time, on the other side of it is the idea of, you know, mainstreaming and starcraft, and we see, you know, in every sport you kind of need those, not just iconic superstars, but them to last for a long time. You need the Peyton Mannings, the Wayne Gretzky's, Michael Jordan's, and so on, who are household names not just for a couple of years, but for a better part of a decade. And those are the kind of people who really start to move the needle with casual fans. And is there something about MMA that just is not conducive to that kind of reach?
To a degree, yes. The detractors of MMA have been saying this for the longest time, that, you know, you can't grow a sport, you can't become mainstream if on any given Saturday, you know, your top guy can get brutally knocked out.
Yeah.
And I understand that there's sort of something to that, but to me, as you were mentioning, the unpredictability of MMA is a lot more appealing than, you know, the somewhat predictable nature of boxing, if we're going to compare those particular sports. I mean, I don't subscribe to the notion that a loss completely kills your superstardom, and, you know, witness the fact that Conor McGregor is more popular today than he was before the first time he lost in the UFC back in March. It's how you deal with the loss.
Yeah.
And Conor put on that fancy suit after that loss in March, and he showed up to the press conference and said, I'll be back.
Yeah.
And you know what? I want to fight this guy again, and I'm going to beat him, and then I'll go on my merry way. And he did that. Ronda handled it a little differently, and I think it has hurt her star power somewhat. I mean, she has just sort of hid from all of us. She has disappeared, and she seems so upset now. I don't know if America can really get behind that. I think America wants to sort of laugh and celebrate and just, you know, kind of root for someone. And she just seems so mad at the world that I don't really understand what she is doing, to be honest. But in MMA, I don't think that losses mean as much as people want to make them out to be.
Yeah.
And I think that, look, fans, you know, the true fans of the sport, they understand just how difficult it is to go, you know, 10-0, let alone 50-0. And I don't think that they're, you know, some of the greatest fighters of all time have double-digit losses.
Yeah.
And no one, you know, no one really begrudges them for them. They're Hall of Famers.
I like this part. You know, the most disappointing sporting event I've ever covered as a reporter was Mayweather-Pacquiao because, it just happened way too late. They just spent years and years screwing around, not being serious about it. But so by the time they finally get into the ring, not just Pacquiao is diminished, but Mayweather too. You're seeing two electric, you know, all-time fighters fighting, you know, in the final vapors of their career. And it was a terrible fight, and everyone overpaid for it, and it just left this horrible feeling. And now they're talking about doing it again, which makes me laugh. But, you know, the
Would
UFC...
Would you cover it if they did it again?
You know, I like Vegas. Can't lie. but though they might do it in Dallas, who knows?
Sure.
Yeah, I'd probably, you know... They're both fun to cover, their characters. But, you know, this is something that Dana has been very public about as well, the fact that they, you know, they're out to satisfy the customer. They're out to make those fights happen and make them happen quickly. And you have a guy in McGregor who, you know, seems to be obsessive about, like, taking the opportunity. I mean, he fought four times within less than a calendar year. I just want to go in the last part of this and talk a little bit about the fighters themselves, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the business and we've talked a lot about sort of the cultural impact of the sport, but I want to talk about the fighters because I feel like, you know, again, I'm an outsider to this. I've spent a little bit of time around, weirdly enough, some of the most elite fighters in the UFC, whether it's Ronda Rousey and Conor McGregor last year in Dublin, and then going years back, Brock Lesnar way up in Alexandria, Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I'm coming to it again from a general sports background. And what I'm, drawn to, of course, are characters, but also just, you know, raw athleticism and intelligence. And I find so much of that in UFC. And it surprised the hell out of me, to be honest with you. Because like anybody else, or like a lot of people, I had this kind of impression of it being, you know, barbaric and you know, lunkheaded and so on, and all those sort of bad characterizations. And what I have found in so many of these athletes, men and women, is an incredible athleticism. I think it is as elite an athleticism as there is in sports, in terms of what it takes, the endurance, the strength training, the having to prepare for any kind of scenario, but also the intelligence of it and the problem-solving aspect of it. And, like, of all people, like, Conor McGregor has been as interesting and articulate about it as anybody I've ever talked to about, you know, problem-solving within sports, because really that's what it is. It's you know, physical chess out there, and it's a funny thing to say about a sport, you know, that draws blood, but there's a great deal of intellectual competition going on out there. And I feel like... I'm curious to get your thoughts on that, because you obviously know the sport great, great more than I do, but it doesn't seem to be something that people talk about too much with regard to it.
Yeah, because, you know, at first glance, they think it's just a barroom brawl.
Yeah.
Boxing is known as the sweet science, but, you know, I kind of feel like this is a sweeter science, just because you have to put together all these martial arts into one concoction and kind of figure out the, you know, the perfect formula for, you know, your style of fighting. And I think that's a very hard thing to do, and it's something that people take for granted.
And the camps are crazy. I mean, the level of, you know, training and different discipline work and the people you bring in and out of there, the cycle through. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's like having to prepare for a Super Bowl and Wimbledon at the same time. You are crossing all kinds of boundaries in terms of your athletic preparation.
Yeah, and to do what they do for five straight minutes.
Yes.
Back in the day in Pride in Japan, their first round was 10 minutes. I mean, 10 minutes straight of that. It's crazy. So as I was saying, you know, I'm a big sports fan. I love watching all kinds of sports, and I would love to cover other sports. I like MMA as well, obviously. I mean, I'm a huge fan. I enjoy the sport. I enjoy everything that goes into the fight. But the reason why I adore covering the sport so much is really because of the fighters. And it's not necessarily because of what they do in the cage, which I'm highly, you know, in awe of, and I respect them so greatly. I mean, I can never even fathom doing what they do, making that walk, going in the cage, doors slam shut, and they go in there and fight another human being. But they're just such amazing people to cover. You know, they're so articulate, they're so down to earth, they're so open, they're so honest. It's never BS. You know, like PR people and back and telling them what to say, and they're giving you nothing. It's and what's so great about it is every single week. You know, this weekend two cards. They have nothing to do with the card on Saturday night. I mean, it's a different set of circumstances. It's life or death for these guys. It's, you know, can they make their next rent? It's can they reach the top of the sport? Can they go up to that next, you know, step on the ladder? It's never mundane. And they have such amazing backgrounds, such amazing stories. And, yeah, you could say that about every sport, but a lot of these athletes don't allow us to get to know them. These fighters are invested in us as media trying to get to know them, because they make more money if they're more popular, you know. So like with the pay-per-view points and all that stuff. So it's really a fascinating sport to cover, and I'm happy to see more people starting to recognize that. And Connor, you know, Connor is a special case because he's incredibly intelligent. The way he speaks is amazingly captivating. But there's a lot of other Conor McGregors out there as well in different ways.
Yeah, sure.
He's just been able to break through given his fighting style, and just because, you know, he's just so damn good at, you know, just the whole package of, you know, selling yourself in the fight game.
From your estimation, what is the most difficult athletic aspect of mixed martial arts fighting? Is it the endurance?
Man, it's hard to pick one, because getting punched in the face with a glove really hurts,
yeah.
You know, or getting kneed in the body, you know, trying to escape an arm bar, trying to escape a rear naked choke. I mean, someone is choking you and you're sweaty and it's just hard to get out. I mean, it's just, oof. Could you imagine, you know, being in a 15-round fight, let alone a 25-minute, you know, championship fight or a main event, and it's like 2 minutes left. Let's say Holly Holm, fifth round of her first title defense against Misha Tate.
Oh my gosh.
She just fought for like 22 minutes.
Yeah.
And now she's, you know, she's on the mat. Misha has her back.
Yeah.
And she's sinking in a rear naked choke. And she has to try to get out of it. Like, there's a human being on your back with their legs wrapped around you in kind of a figure four. And her arm is under your chin and is choking you. How the heck do you get out of that?
Yeah.
You know, in what other sport are you faced with that kind of predicament?
Yeah.
So it's all that sort of combined, you know, having to endure, having to withstand the punishment, and also just how about the mental side of it? I mean, again, walking into a cage and someone closing that door is a little different than walking into a ring, in my opinion, and just fighting another person for five straight minutes.
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, you seriously have to be on a whole other level mentally to do something like that.
This has been tremendous. Can you tell me, you know, tell our listeners where they can always find you and find the product that you do?
Thank you. Yes, I was honored to be on. I've read your stuff for many years, so I appreciate it. So I work for MMAfighting.com. That's my website that I work for. I host a show called the MMA Hour every Monday, which is actually around 4 hours long. This week we went 4 hours and 45 minutes because there was just so much to talk about.
You're like Springsteen, 4 hours. I think that's amazing.
No breaks as well. just straight with all the biggest guests and biggest names in the sport. I also host a show on Thursdays that I'm very proud of called the MMA Beat, which is our version of the sports reporters, where it's me kind of acting like, you know, Dick Schaap and three other journalists. And we talk about, you know, really like the business, the beat, not so much predictions and the actual fights, but just the storylines and things like that. So that's every Thursday on MMAfighting.com. And it's been great covering the sport and seeing how far it's come. And I'm very happy that I could still cover the sport after I was told not that long ago that those days were coming.
Well, it's a cool thing to be covering anything, whether it's a sport or a business or anything that's in such a dynamic period, which clearly the UFC is. And you made the reference to like 1920s leatherhead football. I mean, it really, I almost think it's also got elements of like, you know, 1970s Howard Cosell Monday Night Football era, you know, NFL, in which, you know, football went from, you know, weekend activity to this somehow glitzy glamour thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to see how that all transpires. So it's going to get nothing but interesting from here. Thank you so much, Ariel.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Have a good one.
For more podcasts, check us out at wsj.com/podcasts. Become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and now look for us on the Google Play Music app on Android devices.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.